They got home. It can't be said that they did so with no further incident. Getting the piano into the van had been quite an experience without Moose along to help, given the indifference of the port authority's night shift to their plight. Utna thought she might have strained her back slightly, helping to heave the monstrous crate into the van. On the other hand, that might just have been stiffness caused by having sat bolt upright, tensely watching the mirrors, all the way home. They almost hadn't been able to fit it in. Getting the rear doors closed had required the removal, folding, and stowing alongside of the last bench seat, which meant Kate and Azalin had piled into the front while Edward and Ayn volunteered to ride with the piano. Getting pulled over again in that configuration would definitely not have been a simple matter to extricate themselves from, and the hour was late, so Utna had used extra caution all the way back. When they arrived, she killed the turban on the last leg of the perimeter road around the quad and pulled the van silently into its place on reserve power, then shut it down altogether, and they all sat there for a second, gathering their energies for Phase 3. This part was going to be a bit tricky, too. It was now past 1 in the morning, well after curfew, and getting bagged by the campus police for up after doors locked with a crate tagged as having been released by the Port Authority at 11:40 p.m. would give up the game with the van as well. For that matter, they weren't supposed to be able to get inside at this hour. Anyone roaming around outside the dorms after 11 would find the doors unresponsive to the student keys, to be left with the unpleasant options of sleeping rough or reporting to campus police for a bollocking. That was easy enough for Edward to change, and she'd done so for herself and others on numerous occasions, but in this case it wasn't necessary. As student orchestra director, Kate had access to the band facilities in Alden Hall at any hour of the day or night, which meant that she held a special key with no curfew restrictions. They got out of the van, and as they did, a shadow detached itself from the other shadows near the doors to the wedge, glided across to them, and revealed itself to be the enormous form of Moose McEachern, clad all in black. With an eerie silence about him, he reached into the back of the van and pulled out the piano crate as though it were a packing case full of comic books, perching it on his massive shoulder. A white slash split the dark of night where he showed his teeth in a grin, and then he was off toward the wedge while Azalin and Kate put the seats back in the van. Silently, breath held, they locked up the van and followed Moose into the wedge. Once inside, with the doors locked behind them again, they were home free. Still, they hailed their celebration until they reached the fourth floor, where Moose was just emerging from the freight elevator. That elevator was supposed to be operable only with a special key, issued to students with special mobility problems. Right now, the key lock was being operated by Devlin Carter, who knelt next to the elevator with headphones on, a small microphone taped to the lock plate, and a pair of metal probes inserted into the keyhole, a thoughtful frown on his face. Moose carried the package out of the elevator, put it down softly in the middle of the hall, then turned to Devlin and tapped him gently on the shoulder. Devlin blinked, looked up at him, and then grinned and withdrew the probes. The elevator sighed shut and returned to the ground floor. "Jolly good, what?" Devlin remarked as he detached the microphone and slung the earphones around his neck. "I'm not very good with computers, but locks like me." "Shh," said Moose as he carefully carried the piano between his hands. The ceiling was too low in here for him to put it on his shoulder again. To the door of room 412. Those left behind had prepared the way. The third desk was now standing all the way down at the end of the hall in front of the blocked door to room 401, with a sign that said, "401, please remove," taped to the top. The room door was opened for Moose by Amanda, and the whole group trooped inside after him. Once the door was closed behind them, Kate went to the acoustic damper next to the beds, smiled, and pressed the activator. When the green light came on, the cheering began. Azalin tried to tell the story of how cool Utna had been when they got pulled over, but she talked so fast no one could understand her and had to start over. Moose and Kate demolished the crate, pulled the packing materials off the piano, revealing it to be a gleaming black upright model, and wheeled it to its place along by the wall by the door. Then Kate set about assembling the bench. Amanda got Mountain Dews for everyone out of the refrigerator, and Utna's bravery was toasted, followed by Edward's hacking skills and then the package itself. Devlin busied himself by collapsing the crate into the smallest pile of debris he could manage, then bunging it into the hall trash barrel. Kate sat down, stretched her fingers for a moment, then played a short test piece, Fast and Furious, to test the tuning of the piano. Once finished, she pronounced it adequate for tonight. Utina, unnoticed by the others, stood and stared. It had only been 30 seconds, but still, she had only ever met one, maybe two people who could play a piano like that before. Kate was revealing new dimensions of herself all the time tonight. I'll have to tune it properly tomorrow, she said, but for right now, it's fine. She smiled. Thank you all for your help. Especially you, Utina, she added. I couldn't have done this without you. After all, she went on with a grin toward the Gamelon princess, Amanda couldn't have pretended to be Liza Broadbank. That was so cool, Azalyn repeated. Just as smooth as you please, like passing in a term paper on time. Oh, I get chills just remembering it. Now I really hope you come to Falling Leaves. I'll think about it, said Utina, resolving to find out from someone what that was as soon as possible. The celebration went on for another hour or so, as those not fortunate enough to go insisted on details of the travail from those who had, and then Kate was prevailed upon to play a few numbers, mostly classical pieces with one ragtime thrown in. During the rag, Azalyn drew Utina aside and asked her, "Did you notice?" "Notice what?" Utina replied, puzzled. "Kate's stutter. It's no worse now when she talks to you than to any of us." Utina blinked. She hadn't noticed that, but thinking about it, the Dantrovian was right. When had the change happened? Gradually, she realized, over the course of the evening. It had still been fairly bad when they were stopped by the policeman, but then that was a tense situation all the way around. But her instructions during the geometric exercise at the Port Authority had gotten smoother and smoother, and now, Azalyn was right. "Well, I'll be," said Utina. Azalyn grinned and patted her on the shoulder. "She's never accepted somebody into her inner circle so fast before," she said. "And it's not just because of what you did, either. You're very special. You should feel honored." "I do," Utina said, and meant it. Having seen the way these talented people flocked to Kate, the way she'd handled herself during the course of the evening, Utina was starting to feel the same way about her. At first blush, she seemed so unassuming and harmless, but she was obviously the leader and driving force behind this group of individuals, and her simple request for help had been enough to make Utina take risks over the course of the evening that only now, in retrospect, startled her. Caitlin tried to hide it at times, but she had that brightness about her that really special people, people who are in some undefinable way important to the scheme of things, have. Utina smiled and sat down to listen to her new-minted friend play the piano. It gave her a pang of nostalgia. The piano had been important in her old life, too. But with this happy group of friends around her, she could control it and enjoy the warm heart of the memory instead of recoiling from its edges. She stretched, rolled her shoulders, and winced. "Man, that drive home was a nerve-wracker. I'm still tense." "Let Devlin take care of that," said Azalyn. "He has terrific hands." Devlin, hearing his name, turned. "Eh? What? Discussing me behind my back, Azalyn?" "Utina's back is sore from driving tense," Azalyn told him. Devlin smiled. "Well, Dr. Devlin can help with that, if the lady's willing," he said. "No come-ons, no cheap gropes, no silly excuses for taking things off. Satisfaction guaranteed, or Princess Dessler breaks my fool head, what? I'm not very rich, but I am a gentleman." Utina considered it, looking speculatively at him, and then decided, well, what the hell. His long, thin hands did look strong enough to make inroads against the knots she felt. Might as well let him try. She got a pillow from her bed, lay face down on the floor, and let him go to work. He was dexterous, strong, empathetic, and honorable. In 10 minutes she felt a world better, and he'd been, true to his word, a perfect gentleman. She filed that all away for future reference, thanked him, and sat up, doing a couple of side-to-side stretches before settling cross-legged to listen to Kate play and talk with her other new friends. In another half hour, the others departed, leaving Utina and Kate alone with the package and the late hour. Kate, up making herself some herbal tea with her spirit lamp, was actually considering calling it a night when she noticed that Utina was standing next to the piano, her hand resting gently on the keyboard, gazing thoughtfully at the Yamaha nameplate on the front. Do you play? She asked, sipping her tea. Utina started a little, jolted out of a reverie, and pulled her hand away from the keys as though they were hot. Oh, no, she replied. Not me. She grinned, folding her hands behind her back as she stepped away from the piano. I'm not very musical. I just like to listen. Kate smiled. Well, then, I'll play you something before we go to bed. She finished the tea, switched the dampers back on, sat down, and flexed her fingers. Do you have any favorite songs? None you would know, said Utina, looking away uncomfortably. Caitlin sighed inwardly. This minefield was getting trickier all the time. Well, nothing for it. Maybe some good would come of it. Well, all right, if you're sure, she said. I'll play you an old song from Earth. I like it. It makes me think of my father. She sat for a moment as if gathering herself, and then began plying the keys. It wasn't an intricate melody, but it was pleasant, a bit percussive. After a few moments, it tapered off. And then, to Utina's surprise, Caitlin began to sing, accompanying herself as she did.
Watched it coming up Winslow down South Park Boulevard. It was looking good from tail to hood. Great big fins and painted steel. Man, it looked just like the Batmobile with my old man behind the wheel.
Caitlin's singing voice was so completely different from her speaking voice that for a moment Utina had a hard time believing it. Her speaking voice was soft, a bit husky and tentative, with that ever-present stutter. Her singing voice was pure, clear, and beautiful, her enunciation smooth and unruffled, and it rippled with emotion. As her initial shock faded and Utina started paying attention to what Kate was singing along with how she sang, the song, even with her limited understanding of its context, began to affect her, evoking the piquant warmth of Kate's thoughts of her father in Utina's own heart, though she had never met the man. As Kate played a quiet piano solo, punctuating it with occasional soft, wordless calls, Utina sat down on the floor next to her desk. After a bit more of that, Kate repeated part of the last verse.
Down the road in the rain and snow, the man and his machine would go. All the secrets that old car would know, I still hear him saying.
Here, she suddenly simplified the piano line considerably, playing only a figured bass with one hand and a soft arpeggio with the other, and sang the chorus in a hushed, emotion-packed tone.
Don't you give me no Buick, son, you must take my word. If there's a God up in heaven, he's got a silver thunderbird.
Just as suddenly, she broke back in with the full line, returning her voice to its full volume.
You can keep your Eldorados and the foreign cars absurd. Me, I wanna go down in a silver thunderbird.
She played the melody line a couple more times, softening and slowing it each time, and then left the last note to hang for a moment before letting the piano fall silent. Dad's really more of a black Cadillac man, she said. But I... She stopped as, turning to face Utina, she realized that her roommate wasn't listening. She was sitting cross-legged on the floor, arms wrapped around herself, tears tracking her face, and whatever she was looking at, it wasn't in this room. Kate made an irritated little sound, at herself rather than Utena. Silver Thunderbird wasn't a sad song, but it was emotional, nostalgic, and she felt she should have recognized the other girl's mood better, left it alone until another time. Caitlin knew well the power of the early morning hours to amplify the sadness in a human heart. The sound seemed to snap Utena back to the present. She focused her eyes, blinking away tears, on Kate.
"I'm so sorry," said Kate. "I shouldn't have played such a sentimental song."
Utena got up, dashing at her tears, annoyed with herself.
"No, I'm sorry," she said. "It was beautiful, really. Thank you. You must really love your father. I could hear it in your voice."
Kate smiled softly.
"Well, it's obvious I can't talk very well. Singing is the only way I can really express myself with my voice," she said. "So I put everything I can into it."
She covered the keys, got up from the bench, and said hesitantly,
But I'm a good listener, if you want to talk."
Utena gave her a long, searching look, as though considering. Then her eyes filled again, and she turned away with a soft, growling sound, swiping the back of one hand angrily across her eyes.
No, Kate, I'm sorry. It's sweet of you, but I can't. Not now. It's too soon."
Kate fought down an urge to reach out, touch Utena's shoulder, try, however gently, to get the sufferer to face her. Instead, she asked,
"Too soon since you met me? Or too soon since it happened?"
"Both," said Utena. Without turning around again, she went to her wardrobe, changed into pajamas, and got into bed.
"Good night," she said.
Kate conceded defeat gracefully.
Good night, Utena," she said.
Sighing a little to herself, she switched off the dampers and the lights, undressed in the dark, and climbed up into her own bed. "Dad would have handled that better," she told herself, annoyed. Under the circumstances, her father might have begged to differ, but then he wasn't there. The next day, Utena was up in time for breakfast, and all smiles. How much of it was the healing touch of daylight, and how much bravado, Kate didn't feel qualified to guess, but it pleased her to see it anyway. Still, she made a mental note to be certain and play only upbeat, happy songs on the piano when her roommate was in, especially at night. A week blended into another, and then another, and a term raced past as though in a hurry to be over with. Kate and Utena bumped along comfortably enough, settling easily into a pattern that suited them both. Their interactions were harmonious, if not particularly deep. Kate had the uncomfortable feeling that she was being kept at arm's length after that one glimpse of the raw and bleeding place in her roommate's heart, but she didn't press the issue. These things came at their own pace, or never did, as it suited them, and she liked Utena well enough as a roommate and a person not to risk making her angry by trying too hard to help. Still, they were friends now, and did the things friends did. They talked at night and on the weekends about this and that. Kate said a lot about her family, her three brothers and one sister, her parents. The last were famous in some way Utena hadn't studied enough galactic history to understand yet, but Kate talked about them as though they were just regular folks, and sang little songs she'd written about them to illustrate various points when her powers of speech failed to convey her meaning well enough. Over the course of one dull Saturday afternoon's conversations, Kate learned that Utena was in fact 14, not, as Kate had assumed, her own age of 15. Though they were born in the same year, 2389, Utena's birthday wasn't until December. She was a sophomore because, her records from her previous school being unavailable owing to some sort of disaster, she'd had to test into the Institute and had scored very well,
She still didn't talk about her background, and Kate didn't ask. Some days they walked down the hill into Worcester and shopped. Outside of her school uniforms, Utina had no discernible fashion sense, which appealed to Caitlin for some reason, so mostly they bought books and things for the room. Utina liked teacups and little decorative things, and had a fondness for rose motifs. Caitlin preferred tiger stripes on things, having a soft spot for the animals themselves. Utina had pronounced the pajamas that fit into this personal style choice garish, but agreed that such a motif really wouldn't fit on a tea set very well. One weekend, they borrowed the student council van, legitimately, this time, and brought a couple of comfortable, if ugly, armchairs and a battered but serviceable tea table back from the Salvation Army thrift store downtown. Utina demonstrated herself handy with tools by building a set of shelves to house Kate's stuffed tiger collection, which was threatening to evict her from her bed, and her own growing collection of teacups. Utina started hanging around Alden Hall for orchestra rehearsals, as well as the meetings of Kate's own small band. That group's membership consisted of the IBGF, Edward as engineer, and occasional guest vocals by Ein, whose many skills included yodeling hilariously along with their cover of the Mavericks' version of Blue Moon. Kate took to spending her afternoons sitting on the grassy bank near the track and field complex, composing new pieces for the student orchestra and her own band, while Utina amused herself by running, jumping, vaulting, and refusing to consider competing in any official capacity. They went to the school library to study and used the 5-cent copier in the basement, and because the computer room next to that copier was always emptier and quieter than any of the ones in the actual computer science center, Fuller Laboratories. Utina learned how to use the school's computer systems and the galactic internet, and Kate taught her the correct way to handle, "Are you a girl?" They played video games and took each other's money at cards. Utina was prevailed upon to join Devlin's Dungeons & Dragons campaign, and shortly became renowned in certain circles for being the only player any of them had ever seen who could make a paladin interesting. The IBGF put together a pickup basketball squad and proceeded to dominate the intramural standings in a haphazard but effective fashion for most of the term. Baseball was harder to organize, especially in the fall, which was a shame as Utina was quite keen on it, but her hoop skills were far from unwelcome either. She kept her pitching skills sharp anyway, with Devlin Carter's help as catcher, hoping for a chance to use them sometime. The two denizens of Morgan 412 weren't inseparable, far from it. Kate vanished every afternoon from 4 to 6 on some mysterious errand to the alumni gym, which Utina seemed reluctant to ask her about. Their course load diverged somewhat, Utina concentrating on historical studies and current affairs, while Kate plunged into mathematics and music theory. The last was kind of a formality. Kate could, and often did, take over the teaching duties in the Institute's music theory courses, but she loved it and wouldn't consider dropping it to make way for anything more practical. All in all, it was a comfortable life, full of contentment and quiet, pleasant moments, if not many peaks of joy. Utina bore up well under the weight of whatever had happened to her before her arrival at the Big W. By day, she was cheerful, funny, and friendly, if sometimes a little distant. At night, she kept to herself, and only because Kate's hearing was so very sharp did she know that, whatever Utina's demon was, it still gnawed at her in the dark. One Thursday morning toward the end of A term, she came back from the shower, shut the door, and stood regarding herself critically in the mirror on the back of it. Kate, at her desk, going over the previous night's pre-calc homework, looked up and made a querying sound. "I think I'll grow my hair back out," Utina said in response, doing her best to look at her profile in the mirror. "Cutting it off when I came here was kind of an experiment, and I don't think it worked. It used to be a little longer than yours." "Hmm," Kate said. "What a shame. Looks like it grows fast, though. When you got here, I could still see the back of your neck." Utina pushed a hand through the thick growth of the back of her head. "Yeah," she said, "it grows fast to a point, and then it basically stops." Kate nodded. Dad's does that. It drives him nuts, because it stops a little short of where he'd really like it to be. So sometimes he shaves his head. Utina shivered. I don't think I'd go that far. Good, said Kate. That conversation over, the room was ruled by silence for the next few minutes, while Utina brushed her hair and got dressed for the day. So, Utina said as she sat down on the edge of her bed to put on her shoes, you're not going to be around this weekend? Said Kate. Devlin got the band a gig in Toronto on Saturday. She put down her pen, closed her notebook, and swiveled. Want to come along? Utina blinked. Toronto? Where's that? Canada, Kate replied, gesturing vaguely northwestward. Maybe 8-9 hours. Well, sure, but I'm not really part of the band or anything. Kate made a dismissive gesture. You can help carry stuff, like you did when we played Sir Morgan's Dive. Utina shivered. I hope the place you're playing in Toronto is better than that hellhole. The hellhole in question, more formally Sir Morgan's Cove, was in downtown Worcester. After booking them into it one Thursday night, Devlin Carter had nearly been killed by an extremely irate and rather beer-spattered Amanda Dessler, who had emerged from the place in the hands of the Worcester Police Department with blood on her knuckles and a greasy handprint on the seat of her jeans. No charges were filed and none of any of Devlin's bones were broken, but the band were advised that they probably ought to stop playing in places they couldn't actually enter legally, at least in Worcester. Kate chuckled. Devlin isn't about to make that mistake again, she assured her roommate. It is a bar, but it's near the university. I've emailed a couple of other bands I know who've played there, and they say it's nice. Utina wavered, wary of becoming a seventh wheel, and Kate went on, Besides, I can't leave you alone all weekend. You'd go crazy. You have a passport, right? Sure, Utina said, nodding toward the top drawer of her desk. You need one to go up there? They don't usually ask, but you're supposed to have one, yeah, Kate said. Come on, it'll be fun. I love Toronto. Dad used to take me there every time we came to Earth. It's an experience I want to share. Utina smiled. Okay, if you're sure I won't be in the way. Saturday morning after breakfast they set out, 7 people, a dog, and a slightly frightening amount of equipment, crammed into the vehicle Moose McEachern euphemistically referred to as his van. It was in fact a small school bus, 20 years old and a bit battered, painted in several different shades of gray and brown primer. He had to park it in the backyard of an acquaintance who lived at the bottom of the hill, because only seniors were allowed to have cars on the Big W's campus, let alone utility vehicles. Half of the seats had been stripped from the bus's interior, leaving a large enough space for the big but tidy pile of amplifiers, monitors, mixing equipment, and instruments that powered the Art of Noise experience. Kate said she'd named the band after a 20th century group she was fond of, but nobody else in the galaxy seemed ever to have heard of anymore. Utina certainly hadn't, and so couldn't argue the point. The other half of the seating space was still intact, if not particularly comfortable. 4 bench seats, each rated by some cruel and sarcastic authority for 2 high school students each. Edward and Ayn eschewed the seats in favor of nesting in back amid the equipment, surrounded by the piles of patch cables and whatnot, still linked by satellite to the vast electronic world beyond. Devlin established himself in the right front, Amanda opposite him. Caitlin sat behind him, Utina across from her, and Azalin circulated. With only 1 person in each seat, they could at least bundle jackets and the like behind them and lean against the walls, feet pointing toward the aisle, and achieve some semblance of comfort. Despite the rather harsh conditions, the atmosphere aboard AON-1, for so Moose's custom license plates read, was festive as they pulled out from the quad and headed for I-290. Moose put some bock on the van's overheads, turned down so conversations were still possible, and the friends chatted, did their homework, and read. Eventually, as the day went on, the last two activities went by the wayside, and they just talked or looked out the windows. In upstate New York, near Albany, someone mentioned hunger. Devlin noted that he knew a little place up in Ballston Lake, only 10 or so minutes out of their way, that had good sandwiches and spectacular apple cider donuts. Moose followed his directions, and after one false start at the wrong highway exit, well, it's in Ballston Lake, why shouldn't it have been the flippin' Ballston Lake exit? They found Lakeside Farm, home of the original apple cider donut. After the sandwiches were consumed, 3 dozen sugared donuts joined the rest of the luggage, stacked up high on one of the overhead shelves so that Ayn couldn't just devour them all outright. And then it was back to the throughway and the long westward haul. Utina, who had never traveled this way before, slipped into the curious rhythm of traversing the New York Thruway, where, from Albany West, there is another interchangeable small city at intervals of approximately 1 hour. The time wandered past in a comfortable sort of lassitude. Caitlin seemed to be full of thoughtful smiles this afternoon over a book of 21st century poetry. Sporadic conversations and games of cards broke out here and there, then disappeared again like small fires at a campsite. They reached the Rainbow Bridge at 5:15 in the afternoon, as the shadows lengthened toward evening, and spent the next hour sitting in a too brightly lit waiting room with a vending machine in the corner, while the RCMP went over their documents and poked around in the van. Utina thought she probably should have been slightly nervous. This was the first time she'd tried to cross an international border with the documents she'd been provided, but for some reason she wasn't. She stifled a yawn and stood surveying the selection of items on the vending machine's touch-sensitive display panel. Toothbrushes with toothpaste, cheap pocket combs, birth control devices, socks, soap, handkerchiefs, small sewing kits. Welcome to Canada, we don't have snack food. Miss, Nathishkan? Asked a uniformed woman in the doorway, placing too much emphasis on the last syllable. That's me, Azalin said, standing. It's pronounced Dvir Natashkin. The middle name goes with it. She didn't sound annoyed, just informative, as she stood looking attentively at the customs official. Ah, thank you, said that official, making a note. Miss Dvir Natashkin, my name is Marie, and I have to ask you a couple of questions. Go ahead, said Azalin affably. Wouldn't you prefer to do this in private? Wondered Marie. Not particularly, said Azalin plainly. All right then. You're Dantrovian? That's right. Do any of your, traditional holidays fall within your planned stay in Canada? Asked the official. Azalin thought for a second. Only two, she said. The time of thankfulness for the setting of the sun is tonight at dusk, and tomorrow is the day the colonists from Earth finally understood. I see, said Marie uncomfortably. And are you planning to celebrate either holiday in the, traditional manner? Well, thankfulness isn't much of a celebration. It's just a short song at nightfall and a sacrament, Azalin said. Colonist Day is usually a big deal, but I'll probably have too much to do this time to really give it what it deserves. So that'll be a short observance, too, most likely. That didn't seem to be the answer Marie was looking for, but she jotted anyway, and then said, Well, thank you. I must remind you that the relevant age here in the Dominion of Canada is 18 standard years. Oh, sure, no problem, said Azalin cheerfully. The whole conversation, weird as it struck Utina, seemed to have rolled right off the Dantrovian's back, and as the rather uneasy-looking customs agent left the room, Azalin trotted over to survey the vending machine herself. What was that all about? Utina wondered. Oh, being Dentrovian, I get that kind of thing all the time on Earth, Azalin replied breezily. Just because some of our celebrations can involve a meeting of the flesh, they automatically assume I'm planning to go out in the street and fuck some hapless citizen at random. Ordinarily, Utina thought she would probably have blushed at Azalin's blunt response, except for one thing. She was too busy being shocked by something else. The hard core of bitterness underlying Azalin's breezy tone, so unusual in the sunny Dentrovian, shook Utina for a moment before she thought long enough to understand it. Azalin was deeply offended by her treatment, by the customs agent's assumption that her religion was just an excuse for casual sex, or that the sex involved with her religion was casual, or both, but was fighting not to show it. The spasm of anger passed as rapidly as it had come on, and when Azalin spoke again, it was with a tone of plain, outright irritation. What, no snacks? She said, scowling at the machine. They tell you when you enter the country not to have sex, then they want to sell you contraceptives, and they don't offer you anything to eat. This is a whacked culture. She turned to Utina. Want to help me with colonists, Deg? You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. That's not what it's about. Now Utina did redden a little. She didn't want to offend Azalin, especially after her insensitive treatment by the customs agent. But on the other hand, I think I'd probably better not. Oh. Azalin didn't seem upset. She took the rejection matter-of-factly. Oh, well. Waiting for somebody somewhere, huh? Back home someplace? Far away? Very, Utina replied automatically, then realized what she was saying. Look, Azalin. Don't worry, Azalin said softly, her face suddenly completely serious. Caitlin's that way, too. Only in her case, she's waiting for somebody she hasn't met yet. It's not my way, but I respect it. I won't ask you any more, and I wish you a speedy reunion with the one you love. Her mood brightened again as if someone had thrown a switch, and, the whole thing behind her, she punched a key she had just noticed on the front of the vending machine, changing its selections from the travel items to a wide range of snack foods. Ha-ha! They hid the food! Nasty mean of them! Utina stood looking at the Dentrovian with an expression of mingled amazement and relief, then smiled and fished in her pocket for change.